Hi, listeners. We're back with another episode of Understand South Carolina. This week, we're talking about rising waters. It's a new effort from the Post and Courier to cover the effects of sea level rise and flooding on people's lives in real time. I'm Emery Parker.
And I'm Emily Williams. We're joined today by projects editor Glenn Smith and senior projects reporter Tony Bartlemy. Glenn is overseeing this project, which officially kicked off last week. And Tony wrote the lead story that day. It's about how climate change is speeding up, causing more severe weather events, more sudden downpours. And of course, in Charleston, that means more flooding.
Right. And we just saw that today, actually, the day that we're recording this. We expected some bad weather, and then unexpectedly, that weather turned into Tropical Storm Bertha, bringing rain and a lot of heavy winds to the area.
So, right. So, we saw severe weather just today. So, Glenn, can you kind of explain, because we knew there was going to be some rain, possibly some flooding this morning. So, there was some planning, because this Rising Waters project is in place on if we were going to send people out and go report on that today. So what's the thought process now that we're doing this project and working on it whenever we know a weather event, a flooding event might be happening the next day?
Yes, we have a whole team of people, about a dozen reporters, maybe three, four, five photographers, some digital folks all teaming up to try to tell this story of incremental climate change in a very breaking news fashion with an investigative edge to it. And it requires some planning for the day's events. Oftentimes, though, the weather just messes with you no matter how much planning you do. Last week, we had an event that was forecast to have very minor flooding, and it dumped about 5 inches of rain on the peninsula and the surrounding area and pretty much drowned everything and created massive flooding. Today, there was a forecast to have a big storm crawling up the coast from Florida. It had dumped 5 to 10 inches on southern Florida, and the Carolinas was right in the sights. And then it looked like it was going to stay off the coast and have very minor flooding. And then they called for more flooding, and then it turned into Tropical Storm Bertha. So it was about 5:36 in the morning. We were all watching the National Weather Service, local amateur meteorologists and folks, and trying to just get a good sense of what to do. And I think around 6 or 7 o'clock, we decided to activate the team and send people out around 7:30 or 8. So we fanned out across the region.
And that's also what happened last week as well, right? When we actually saw more flooding, then we sent out this team. What kind of happened throughout the day? Because I know last week that was more of a full day process, because that we really saw quite a bit of flooding last Wednesday. How did that play out throughout the day? Because we had some coverage already ready, right? And then we were weaving in different things. So how did that day play out?
Yeah, so this is kind of like a novel approach to how we're doing this, is that we do a lot of reporting ahead of time, looking into the science of climate change, government regulations, different challenges people are facing. We're trying to show the effect of climate change in a very holistic way, from the economic challenges and pitfalls to how it affects people on a very personal level. So we had a bunch of material. It was sort of half ready to go. Some stuff was very ready to go. Some stuff was going to be written through as we did it. And it just started raining and raining and raining and raining. And there wasn't supposed to be that big of an event, but it was clear that it was, the roads were filling up quickly. In the middle of that, there's a tornado warning. Tornado goes through John's Island. It's very challenging to figure out when you send people out in those circumstances, because it's dangerous out there. And, you know, you're putting yourself at a little bit of risk, but we managed to do so and get out there and really get in the thick of things in a safe manner, and the story done.
I know on Twitter the next day, I saw a lot of people saying, this is a great package of stories. How did they get it out this quickly? You know, this all happened yesterday. But of course, this took time and a lot of work to plan out. When did you start working on this and planning this? And Tony, when did you actually start writing that main story?
Yeah. So thanks, Emily. We probably began before the pandemic. We had this idea of covering climate change in an entirely new way. That's, I think, the most significant aspect of this project, is that we're trying to inject a sense of urgency that you see in the kind of breaking events that we always experience, and then add this new layer, this deeper layer of the science behind climate change, the challenges they pose. So I've done a lot of climate change stories over the years, and then began before the pandemic, and then had a kind of a loose idea of how to write it before this last week's event. And the kind of the notable thing about both today's tropical storm Bertha and last week's rainstorm was its utter unpredictability, or its seeming unpredictability. Both times we thought we would get some rain, both times something surprising happened.
Right, and with the storm today, this is the second named story already this year, right? And we're not to the official start of hurricane season. How often have we been seeing that happen in the last several years? Getting these named storms before we're actually officially supposed to be in that time of year.
It's really unusual because we're, 5 days away from hurricane season beginning, and we typically don't see a lot of storms until July or August, or really September and October. So I think this is part of a pattern, this global, instead of global warming, perhaps it's better to call it global weirding, as Tom Friedman talks about. We're seeing these sort of erratic, unpredictable, supercharged weather events.
And that's also part of the reason why, right, you wanted to take this approach of mixing breaking news, mixing this longer reporting for when these unexpected or unpredictable days come up, right? Because you don't quite know when it's going to happen, so you want to be ready. Glenn, how did this idea come around, I guess, and how does this compare to how our papers covered flooding in the past?
I think we've covered it the way a lot of people cover it, in that we write on the breaking event, we talk about roads closing down, we talk about hassles people are having, flooding on the streets. And then we do deeper dives later on that take a look at some of the science behind it, some of the flood regulations, the impacts on people. But they seem to be kind of like divorced in a way, right? The two elements are often separated by days, weeks, or months, and not really combined to add that greater context and to connect all the dots. This grew out of a conversation we were having, Tony and I, with Mitch Pugh, the executive editor. And Mitch was saying, boy, we've done such amazing stuff, really documenting these flooding events as they happen. And then we've done this great enterprise work later on that explores all these different facets of climate change and the failure to protect properties and building in dangerous areas and such. What if we connected all those dots and did all those things we've done in the past with the event itself to really help readers see what a dire threat this poses to the region in so many different ways, and put all those pieces together in one place and really put it out in front of the public and foster a greater conversation on this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the terms that we used in the like packaging of this project is a climate emergency. Can either of you talk a little bit about like what do we mean when we say climate emergency? And
have any of you guys seen that Bill Nye video?
Where I have, but maybe some of our listeners haven't. If you want to,
Bill Nye, very well known science guy, gets on the John Oliver show, and he takes a fire, or he lights the globe on fire, and he basically says the planet's on effing fire. Safety glasses off, and just lays into it, you know, that there is ample evidence that we've essentially broken the climate, and we're in a this very, very significant emergency situation, but we're not feeling it, right? Where these kinds of sort of slower events are hard to respond to. They're overwhelming. They're kind of slow to identify, and so we're really trying to create that sense of urgency that we have when we have a breaking event, because it recognizes our human nature of focusing on what's in front of us.
And Tony, right in the headline of your piece, you wrote "Forget about climate change." I think the phrase "forget about climate change" is definitely eye grabbing, but that it's about climate speed. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I think so. Over and over, I've heard people say, "Climate change." Climate's always changed, and that's sort of a throwaway explanation for what's going on. And while the vast majority of people understand that human beings have created this climate situation, a significant number, small but significant number, still don't get it. And so we wanted to answer that question. Forget about climate change. The real story is about the pace of change and how global warming has essentially speeded up all the processes that are that affect the climate. It's a theme that's really hasn't been kind of hit home by a lot of other newspapers. Mm-hmm.
If I could add too, I think it's been happening in such an incremental way that we've all grown to adapt to it to a certain extent. If you went back 10 years ago and you were driving along the Crosstown Expressway, this major artery through the middle of the city that was built in a watershed, occasionally you might run into some floodwaters. But certainly if it was flooding and coming over the hood of your car and drowning your automobile, that would have been big news. But now we've sort of adapted to it. We work at different times of the day. We take different routes. We've all found ways to kind of ignore the fact that the sea is rising and flooding this area on a regular basis. We had 89 sunny day flooding events last year, which is a record-breaking number of events. The harbor has risen a foot since 1920? And it's rising, as Tony said, mm-hmm. at a much faster rate. But because it happens in these just little ways that eat away at our life, we don't notice the enormity of what we're facing. So we're trying to bring that all home.
That's a good point, Glenn. Imagine if you went to sleep like Rip Van Winkle 50 years ago, and then you woke up 5 years ago and then experienced that 1,000-year flood, then experienced Irma and Matthew, Dorian, year after year after year, then, a 5-inch rain in April, and then a 5-inch rain in May. Say, hey, this is an emergency.
Yeah.
Right. And the 1,000-year flood, I know that was something that you included in your story. So for that, we're talking about the flooding in October 2015. But of course, even though it's called a 1,000-year flood, and so in theory, you shouldn't see something like that again in your lifetime easily, right? Over the last several years, just still seeing record rainfalls, record flooding every year, right? So still using that term 1,000-year flood for that event, but that's not actually, I guess it just doesn't seem accurate, right? For what we're dealing with now.
No, clearly we're having to rewrite what we mean by 1,000, 500, 100-year floods because of these accelerating forces.
I feel like I probably should interject that we are aware that the technical definition of 1,000-year flood doesn't mean that it can only happen once in 1,000 years. So before people send us angry emails, we are of course aware of that. So the point being though that these extremely rare events are happening more frequently than we would expect them to happen. And that's the bottom line, whatever you call it.
Yeah, that's a good point, Emery, that one weather event, it's really difficult to connect it to climate change, but multiple events, you have a pattern.
It's interesting when you say too that it wasn't that long ago that running into the kind of flooding we get on the crosstown pretty frequently would be big news. I think there are plenty of people with how many new residents Charleston has, who, myself among them, who since they've lived here, that's been the norm. So that's kind of an interesting perspective a newspaper that's been here for many, many years can give too. How actually does this compare to Charleston's history of flooding? I know that one of the things too is the severity, right? So not just the frequency, but the severity. And Tony, I know you wrote about that as well, that people are seeing these more unexpected, more severe events. Why is that? Why is it that not only are these events more frequent, but they're becoming more severe and more unpredictable?
So in simple terms, because we've been burning so much, so many fossil fuels, so much carbon we've unleashed into the atmosphere, we've essentially generated this enormous amount of greenhouse gas that traps heat. Most of that heat ends up going into the ocean, which is also warming. The ocean's this giant heat sink. But a lot of it goes into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is warming. It's warmed about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 50 years. And when you have a warming atmosphere, that atmosphere is able to hold more moisture. And then unload that moisture in the form of rain. So you have more moisture, more rain, heavier rains, more intense rains, and also it creates this tremendous ripple effect in a lot of other ways too. So that's one reason why we're having all these unusual events.
I thought in the story, Tony, you really, that comparison you had to that rain bomb event, I forget how many millions of gallons of water came down, but you compared it to basically having Niagara Falls unload on Charleston over, the course of an hour or something like that?
Yeah, I calculated a square mile, how much rain would be. So roughly 2 feet of rain fell over the peninsula of Charleston in 2015, really turning the peninsula into part of the Atlantic Ocean. Mm-hmm. And so I calculated how much volume of water that would be over 1 square mile, and it came out to be essentially like as if somebody put Niagara Falls on Charleston for an hour, dumped that much water. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the Atlantic Ocean, of course, when we're having these more frequent rain events, more powerful, our sea level is also rising. That's kind of the other main element of this, right? We're getting more of this severe weather at the same time that our sea level is rising. So, and you spoke to this a little bit earlier, but just how much the sea level has risen here in the Charleston area. What does that look like? And also, when did scientists start rethinking sea rise?
So Charleston's really lucky in a way. We have this gauge near near Waterfront Park that has been measuring temperatures for more than 100 years, or measuring water level, sea level, for more than 100 years. So we've got this great data set. And we know that sea level has risen about a foot in the past century. But in the past, scientists really thought the trend line was kind of linear. It was kind of just as if it was a straight hill upward. But what they found was, because of a rapidly warming planet, we're seeing more of a curve upward. It's an accelerating curve. It's mathematicians call it a quadratic curve, which gives me a headache just thinking about it. But so we're seeing this increasing, as it's accelerating rise in the sea level, which is really, that's sort of the new thing. So, well, sea level has risen maybe an inch or two over the last few decades. Now it's rising at about 2 inches. In the next decade or so, it'll increase to 3, and then it'll keep going higher for the rest of this century.
And I think, you know, one of the things that's important to realize when we're talking about sea level rise is that, you know, the numbers might sound kind of small when you think about it, but one of the things that we always watch in the past couple of years, and we've had all these tropical storms, these near misses, we always pay a lot of attention to the timing, like when the storm is going to, you know, approach Charleston or the coast, and how that relates to tide. And so you see some interesting things can happen. For example, the most recent storm that came through had, you know, we recorded one of our all-time highest tides. And, you know, it's a situation where it just, you're creating the circumstances where, as bad as like Hugo was in the 80s, you know, a few extra inches in the harbor, when you're talking about like a big storm coming in, something like when you're talking about storm surge happening, yeah, that can really make a big difference. So it's not, you know, it's not that one day, like one wave is just going to come in and then Charleston's like underwater forever. It is really more about these extreme events and how we're just moving the baseline of these extreme events.
Yeah, Emery, you make a really good point there. Just, you know, think about what 1 degree or 2 degrees temperature would do if that was your body temperature.
Right.
You know, that's the difference between healthy and being feverish. And so the body temperature of the climate is reaching a feverish level. So even just a 1 foot rise in the sea level in Charleston would regularly flood 64,000 acres in Charleston County. Essentially, we'd be moving high tide up a foot, and that would affect 64,000 acres, 1,000 homes and offices and buildings.
So I know one of the ways that we've phrased this, just particularly because of our geographic position, is that Charleston is on the front lines of the climate crisis, right? And when it comes to covering an issue like this and working on a project like this, of course we're looking at the science, but flooding and these weather events, they affect so many different segments of the community, different aspects of it. So how are we thinking through and planning what elements of that to cover, right? It affects businesses, it affects different communities in different ways. So Glenn, what can people expect going forward? What are we looking into, and what are we trying to delve into with this lens of flooding and severe weather and these issues?
Yeah, we're looking at a whole pile of different issues. Tony and I were out today in the thick of this, taking water samples around the different areas of the region to try to get a sense of what's in that water we're all walking through. We have people going out into communities up in the Charleston Neck area, the thin area that connects the peninsula to the larger region. Go up into some of these low-income communities that historically have not received the same attention as perhaps the tourist areas around the market, but have struggled kind of in silence for years, and now we're really facing a dire threat from the number of flooding episodes. We're talking to business leaders about lost productivity, people stuck on roads, unable to reach the jobs. You're losing an hour or two at the end of the day. Talking also, you'll be talking, Emily, to business leaders about, you know, already getting hammered during the coronavirus and the shutdown and the lockdown, and, you know, combating the rising sea at the same time. We'll be talking to first responders trying to reach people in crisis as, you know, they're also trying to take precautions against the coronavirus. There's just so many stories out there. Everybody's affected. Around the hospital district, we've just opened this multi-million-dollar children's hospital in this hospital complex that is probably the jewel of the South Carolina medical system, sitting right in a basin over there that regularly floods. I mean, these are all, it's just so impactful across so many different people's lives and so many different segments of society. So there are lots of stories to tell.
Yeah, I can say that so many businesses are so nervous right now about hurricane season and about getting a really bad storm because their savings are just drained right now from the last couple of months of having to shut down. Do we have any idea, any predictions at this point of what this hurricane season might look like?
Forecasters have predicted a higher than normal hurricane season. That can mean anything. That could mean we get hammered a bunch of times. It could also mean a lot of storms just churn up the Atlantic and don't hurt us. But it sort of speaks to this pattern of accelerating forces and in more active hurricane seasons. Mm-hmm.
Given how on the front lines Charleston is when it comes to these issues, what do we know that the city has done at this point to, say, reduce our carbon footprint? I know, Tony, that's something that you've written about before.
Yeah, no, the city for a long time had its head in the sand when it came to a lot of these issues. My favorite anecdote is that the city had this planning document called the Century 4 plan, and it was this massive planning document that described how the city would shape itself during the coming century. It didn't mention sea rise once. That was a very telling thing. That was about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Then we had all these storms, and then we've had some aggressive coverage by the paper, and now the city, I think, is taking it very seriously. We have lots of activity, lots of, I think, concern. The city, when it comes to its own carbon footprint, like the newspaper, is lagging. We're all of us probably could be doing more and should be, but the city's carbon footprints, they have to deal with a lot of other things like flooding projects, and it's a lot of competing needs.
And I know, of course, we are seeing some work in terms of city projects related to sea level rise, right? We're seeing the battery wall. We've also seen a plan from the Army Corps of Engineers of what it would look like to put a wall around the city again, like Charleston had many, many years ago. But now for this reason of sea level rise. So we're definitely seeing some movement and thought around that, but just knowing how long any type of municipal project can take, it seems at odds with this speed that you're describing, right? If we can come up with a solution that gets us to where we need to be in time, with kind of racing that sea level rise and racing that those severe weather events.
A reporter, Chloe Johnson, who is also part of the Rising Waters team, she did this great, great deep dive into that wall, its history, and the challenges that project faces. That's a massive, massive infrastructure project that actually does absolutely nothing to solve our flooding problems.
Mm-hmm. It would keep out storm surge during big hurricanes and storms, but there is some fear that it would trap floodwaters like we saw today or last week in the city and not allow them to drain, because it's not really designed to deal with that sort of thing, nor is it able to protect under the current design some of those low-income communities like I was talking about. It's not a uniform barrier that's going to protect everybody. There's no money appropriated for it. There's a lot of competition for those dollars. Just even the city's estimate of what it needs to tackle the flooding issue, a couple of years ago, they said it was around $2 billion. And yeah, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of planning that would have to go into all this, a lot of cooperation with the state, the federal government. And you're right, that sort of belies the sort of creeping threat and these events that we are seeing on an all too regular basis. But mm-hmm. seems to be what we're faced with.
Yeah. If anybody's interested in learning some more about that, I know we did an episode last year about some of these topics in the wake of the like Dutch Dialogues project. I mean to make a long story short, it's a very complicated problem with lots of different solutions and no one magic bullet. But if you're interested in that, I know we had a more in-depth conversation about that on a previous episode, so you can go find that and listen to it.
What are we hearing from Charleston residents? Because that's, of course, one of the goals of this project, too, is to find people who are experiencing this in their day-to-day lives, who are personally worried about flooding. What in this first package, what are some of the things we are hearing from those from those people just about their concerns, about how this affects, like I said, their day-to-day lives?
I think we're hearing a chorus of frustration, a little bit of fear, because it's such an overwhelming subject, and these forces, you know, suddenly they're upon us, and they're, you know, the hurricane is such a powerful event that it creates this feeling of anxiety, uncertainty, I don't know, you know, makes people question where they live, their futures. Mm-hmm. So I think you have that sort of, you know, that layer of anxiety. Plus, you've got another layer of anxiety about the coronavirus, plus everybody else's usual day-to-day things that they're dealing with. So I think these flooding events, you know, create a lot of anxiety. And, you know, we hope, you know, as part of this project also to help guide some of that anxiety toward a more positive direction, and without giving false hope.
But there are some things, like through the Dutch Dialogues, which were aimed at finding ways to live with water, that we could probably learn some very good lessons from. And it's part of a larger conversation. It's going to take, not only the city making some actions, but individuals doing things to reduce their own carbon footprint and do their part. We're going to suggest some of those things in the coverage to come, some ways you can help out. To Tony's point, there is that anxiety. There's that. I talked to a fellow down on Charleston's east side, which is a neighborhood that's had some struggles over the years. And he grew up there, and he's in his 60s now, and he runs a small store. And he was showing me a tree the other day. He said, this is the line where the floodwater used to come when I was a kid, and now it's up a block further than that. And when he was a kid, it was this very vibrant neighborhood of mixed races and ethnicities, and there was a lot of jobs. There was a cigar factory, the Navy base, the port. It was this very thriving area. And then over the years, a lot of those jobs dried up when the Navy base closed and the cigar factory closed. And the neighborhood fell on some hard times, and crime set in. There was a lot of drug dealing in the neighborhood. It's starting to turn the corner now. There's a lot of people investing in there. You're seeing more diversity, more economic investment, and he's all for that. And I think people in the neighborhood are pretty excited about that. But they worry now that there's this threat from the flooding that comes and, you know, it wrecks those properties. It consumes cars. It just wreaks havoc, right? They don't want to see the progress lost.
Right. And I know you mentioned this briefly, that there will be, in future coverage, some suggestions of what people can do, some actionable items. I know kind of all of this information, Tony, like you're saying, can make people feel overwhelmed, maybe a little just anxious that they can't do something. But that will be another element of this, right, is proposing some things that people can do.
Yeah, no, we broke the climate. We can fix it, I hope. There are lots of things we can do.
On that note, Glenn, what can we expect from the future of this project? Because it's not just one thing that we did last week or today. This is something that's going to be ongoing. What can we expect from the future? What can listeners do to help us report this story?
Well, a couple different things. One, we are actively looking for people who face challenges from flooding, whether it be commuting to work or trying to pick up their kids or just protect their property from the floodwaters. We're interested in hearing from people who are facing these challenges, and we'd love to tell those stories. And we'd love to spend some time with them during flooding events and really chronicle what they're going through so people see what their friends and neighbors and colleagues have to deal with this crisis. That's one thing. So you're free to contact me or Tony or Chloe or just write to newstips@postandcourier.com and share your story, and someone will get that to us. And I can't stress enough how much we do want to hear from readers. The other thing you can do is we have a Post and Courier investigative fund that is helping underwrite some of the water testing we're doing to see, you know, what sort of stuff you're slogging through in that filthy soup that fills up our roads. And it's going to pay for a Freedom of Information Act requests that could be quite expensive to access documents and other things we need to find out to check the city and the state on its progress and to see what's been done over the years. Some of these endeavors are quite costly, and you know, we appreciate every donation and dollar we can get to help with that.
Great. And what are the best ways that listeners can get in touch with either of you, whether that be Twitter, email? What are the best ways to reach you?
Tony and I are both on Twitter. I'm GlennSmith5. Tony, what's your handle?
I'm at T Bartlemy, at T-B-A-R-T-E-L-M-E, or go to our website and click on one of our stories.
Yeah, and our contact information is at the bottom of each story. You can hit us up on Twitter. You can send us emails. You can call on the phone. You can write to newstips@postandcourier.com. There's so many ways to reach us, but we would like to hear from you.
Yep. And if you have comments or questions or suggestions about this podcast in particular, we're on Twitter. The best way to get in touch with us is to tweet at us. We're @UnderstandSC. Well, thanks so much, Glenn and Tony, for joining us this week and explaining this project.
Thanks for letting us share some of our work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Didn't Glenn have a climate change joke, though?
Well, now you got to say
a joke. Yes.
Yeah, I think he has maybe two.
What?
Yep.
We got to hear him.
Oh, you got to hear it. You gotta
why
say
did
it
the climate need some privacy? Because it was changing.
God.
I'll spare you the second.
What?
No. It could redeem you. What's the second one?
Yeah, what's the second one?
Why is it good to talk global warming with a prospective person of the opposite sex you might be courting? Because it's a good icebreaker.
I kind of like that one a little bit more. Okay. That's not bad.
All right.
What did one hurricane say to the other?
I don't know.
I have my eye on you.
Oh.
And we can
all right.
go
okay.
on.
Okay.
Well,
we gotta stop there.
On that note, again, thanks so much for joining us, and we will be back next week with another episode of Understand South Carolina. All right, and that's all. Understand South Carolina is a production of the Post and Courier in Charleston. Our theme song is by Billy Fountain. You can stream his music by searching for Billy, that's with an IE, Fountain, on Spotify. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can get in touch with us by emailing understandsc@postandcourier.com, or, of course, you can tweet at us with any questions or comments. And if you're a fan of the show, please take a second to like us and leave a rating on the Apple Podcast Store. See y'all later.